to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. Prison, of course, we know is never a fun place to be, but during the Revolutionary War, the place you really didn't want to end up was in solitary confinement in Connecticut. Well, that's just where William Franklin found himself, and if that name sounds familiar, well, that's because, yes, he was Ben Franklin's son. And if ever there was an estranged father-son relationship, this was it. Our guest today knows this whole story. Jessica Jenkins is the executive director of the Litchfield Historical Society. And it was in Litchfield where the Patriots had their notorious solitary confinement quarters. And just wait until you hear Jessica's description of that. This week's trivia question, the United Nations wasn't supposed to be in Manhattan. The original selection by the committee was for a town in Connecticut. Which one? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. Ben Franklin and his son William Franklin ended up their lives, unfortunately, estranged from one another. They were on not only opposite sides of history, but the opposite sides of the Atlantic. Ben, of course, was a very strong American patriot, one of our coveted founding fathers. And like his dad, William, of course, was British, and the two of them in the first couple of decades had a very strong father-son relationship. In fact, we're going to talk about the story of one of their more important joint undertakings. And this was the famous incident, I know you've heard about it, where there was a kite flown with a key attached to the string, and this was designed to attract lightning in an early experiment on electricity. We'll talk about how they worked together on that. But in later years, when it came time to pick sides in the American Revolution, well, the two parted ways, at least philosophically. Well, there's an interesting sidebar topic when you're talking about the Franklin family, and that was their tendency to father children out of wedlock. Turns out it was something that Ben and his son William both ended up doing, as did William's son much later down that timeline. Well, it's a fascinating overall story about one of our most famous historical figures and his family. And we're lucky to have Jessica Jenkins with us here to tell us all about the story. Jessica is the executive director of the Litchfield Historical Society. And when things got so bad for William that he was eventually arrested by American patriots and jailed, well, he was placed in a notoriously nasty prison facility in Litchfield. Jessica, it is hard to know where to start this story, because oftentimes when you're talking about a famous figure in history, you talk about their birth date. And in this case, you can't really do that, because that's a little bit muddy, because William Franklin was born out of wedlock to Ben Franklin and a woman unknown. So let's kind of start there. It's, you know, at the beginning of his life, you know, he'd turn out to be the governor of New Jersey, the last royal governor of New Jersey before the Revolution. So he went to great prominence, but started off life with a bit of a question mark hanging over his head, didn't he?
He did, Mike. So William Franklin, as you mentioned, is the son of Benjamin Franklin, the founding father that we are all very familiar with his name. And that question mark is, we know he was born sometime around 1731. The question is, was it 1730? Was it 1731? And we don't know who his biological mother was. We do know that he was raised by Benjamin and Benjamin's common-law wife, Deborah. But as you said, you know, especially at that time period, that means that William was really growing up with this kind of stigma over him of being an illegitimate child. That said, he still had a lot of opportunities afforded to him. Benjamin was pretty clear about the fact that he thought that making as much available to a child was really important. So that may have led to a little bit of spoiling in William's case, but he had access to all of the books in Benjamin's store. Benjamin, with his notoriety, his connections throughout William's life, was able to make connections for him, get him a good education. And so, as you kind of noted, William Franklin was able to really rise from this point as a boy where it was probably pretty painful because his illegitimate status was being brought up fairly regularly to really a point of notoriety as a royal governor in New Jersey.
Now, when he was, I guess, late teens, early 20s, somewhere in that time frame, depending again on his, you know, year of birth, he did something that I don't think a lot of people know this side of the story. When you hear about Ben Franklin flying the kite and testing for electricity, at least the way I always heard it, I thought Ben Franklin was flying the kite. But as it turns out, I guess it was actually his son William who was with him, helping him conduct that experiment. Was that the case?
That is correct. So William was very much involved in Ben Franklin's electrical experiments. And William not only was the one kind of taking that kite, running through the cow pastures to get that up in the air, but my understanding is that he had actually played a part in designing that silken kite. And he also, even more so, he was working with his father to describe the path of the lightning and installing lightning rods. And so really being a key part of those experiments. When Oxford University awarded Benjamin an honorary doctorate, I believe it was in 1762, at the same time, they actually also conferred an honorary master's degree on William for his contributions to those electrical experiments. So that's, again, one of those moments where history has kind of really glorified Benjamin Franklin and almost kind of forgotten William's role in that, which seems like it was a very crucial part of getting through those experiments and getting to those great findings that we remember.
I'm glad you mentioned the year 1762, because this was a key year for William Franklin. He goes back to Europe with his dad, and he goes there to study the law. And he actually follows up on what his father had done, and then he has an illegitimate child in London.
That is correct. He also had an illegitimate son, also named William. His name was William Temple. So we kind of see that Franklin pattern and legacy of what that looks like. And then pretty quickly after siring his son William, William Franklin then marries Elizabeth Downes, who's a London socialite. She had really important family ties to the West Indies. And that, in many ways, I think kind of solidifies William into this social society. So he's really done well for himself, you know, going studying law, becoming a lawyer, marrying into the social set in London. So I think you're right, kind of that early 1760s period, we see him really starting to get his feet under him in a really firm way.
And in fact, it's what, a year later or thereabouts where he is given the assignment of his life. He's given the royal governorship of New Jersey. I think it was 1763. And he would turn out to be the last royal governor in New Jersey before the revolution occurred and they go to another, you know, form of government. But he was it. And he was not a tyrant by any stretch of the imagination, right? I mean, he formed Rutgers University and did a couple of other notable things while he was in.
Yeah, absolutely. As a royal governor in New Jersey, I believe he was actually showed himself to be very able at the job. He very successfully was able to really politic with his General Assembly in New Jersey without a lot of quarreling. He put up a lot of popular reforms, a lot of road work, construction of bridges, as you had mentioned, Rutgers University. And he was also known for really taking an interest in curtailing imprisonment for debt, pardoning women who had been sentenced for adultery, which I find a little interesting given his family's past with illegitimate children. So he definitely was a royal governor who was doing a lot of reform and I believe was looked fairly, you know, highly upon for the efforts he was able to put forward and move forward in a positive way.
And I'm sure his dad at this point is so proud of him and things are going well. And then this is when things start to change, right? Because now the mood in the country is starting to be, hey, look, you know, the British are, you know, taxation without representation, all the rally the troops to say we're going to take this country back. And I would imagine, I mean, this is just me speculating, but I would imagine if I'm sitting in the royal governor's chair in New Jersey, getting that pay and having a good life, I wouldn't want to see that change either. So let's keep that going. And in fact, he makes a very famous speech to the legislature as he starts to see things spinning out of control, called the Two Roads speech. You know, we have two roads we can go down. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that what you're getting at here is that William Franklin really had a good handle on what he was seeing, and he was really cautioning against the horrors of what he saw as a civil war, of, you know, people being loyal to the crown coming at these clashes with the rebels, in his view, the revolutionaries. And there's two roads that they could take. And I think that if we put it into today's words, it's pretty basic to him. You can either take this route and go one direction. You can remain loyal to the crown. To him, he saw that as the direction in the future. He, you know, definitely saw himself loyal. He saw himself as a British citizen. And the other path that I think he was very much cautioning against was this road of rebellion and revolt. He was so deeply ingrained in his loyalty to the crown that I think he also truly believed that most colonists would not support the revolution and be in rebellion, but that ultimately they would stay loyal to the crown because, as you pointed out, for William himself, he was sitting in a very good spot being governed by the British government and playing a role in that.
Now, the legislature, after hearing his Two Roads speech, then voted, as I read it, unanimously to back the Patriots and the rebel cause. And this is when things really start to go south for him, because then he is placed under house arrest at the beginning of the year 1776. Do I have that right?
Yes. And in fact, he actually, his official arrest and being put into house arrest actually happens on July 4th of 1776, which often we remember as, you know, July 4th, 1776. This is a big marking day for the independence of America. And that is the same day that Franklin is officially a prisoner of the rebel government. He is confined to house arrest in Wallingford, Connecticut. They moved him from New Jersey up to Connecticut, which was really considered a safe hold where a lot of loyalist prisoners and prisoners of war were being held at that time.
And then he, I guess, is doing okay and is going into his next stage of incarceration, which is parole, and he's getting ready to move back, I guess, into society. And he goes to another house. I think that one was in Middletown, correct?
That is correct. So after he was in Wallingford for just a short stint, he was moved to Middletown, Connecticut, there on the Connecticut River, and he was in a parolee status while he was there. So he was given free movement around town. He was actually given a lot of liberties. Where William got himself in a sticky point, though, is that William kind of always from the beginning had made it fairly obvious he was not going to be a compliant prisoner. Again, that strong loyalty he had to the crown, he really wanted to use his knowledge, his connections to gather intelligence and to pass that along to loyalists as much as he could. And it was during that time in Middletown where he had a little bit more leash to work on that he got himself in a little bit of a snag. Not only was he moving on that intelligence to other loyalists, but he also got himself into a situation where he was attempting to issue written pardons to loyalists in Connecticut and New Jersey. And when the rebel government, you know, caught wind of that, that wasn't going to sit for them. So he was going to come off of that parole status. And they decided at that point that he needed to be moved into a much higher security situation, and in essence, he needed to be punished for his bad actions, and they needed to safeguard that he was not going to be passing information on to loyalists or kind of muddying the waters in using his influence in ways that would harm the revolution in their eyes.
Now, this had to be a tender situation, because here you're dealing with the son of one of the key players in Philadelphia at that point in time, and a guy who's dealing with France, who would be our great ally during this fight. And, you know, and you've got his son that you're dealing with. I know everybody was aware of that. And so they make the very difficult decision, and this is where Litchfield now comes square front and center into this story. They bring him up to Litchfield, and what do they do with him there?
So they, in essence, they throw him on a horse in Middletown, and they bring him up to Litchfield, which Franklin himself later wrote that they took him on a grueling 40-mile journey up to Litchfield to get up into this region. They are on horseback. They are making it up into the Berkshire foothills. And he arrives here in Litchfield. And when he found out where he was going, he had an idea of what his fate was. Litchfield at that time, the Litchfield jail, was a place that was known for holding loyalists, holding British prisoners, and it was not a place that you wanted to be. Often, I think we as historians think about Old Newgate Prison as this, like, the epitome of, oh, you did not want to be there in the Revolution. That was a horrible jail to be in. But right behind that, in, you know, notoriety of being this notorious place, was the Litchfield jail. So they bring him up here. He is delivered to Sheriff Lynd Lord, who directly orders his men to take Governor Franklin quickly up to the solitary cell on the second floor of the Litchfield jail. And that was not a place that William Franklin wanted to be.
Can you explain to us what you know from your research of the conditions of that second floor?
Absolutely. Looking at the historic documentation, there are some pretty good descriptions of what the Litchfield jail at that time was like and what those conditions were. And William Franklin actually wrote about that himself. So the jail in Litchfield was a log or wooden structure that was down at the bottom of East Street. And I think that what gets to it even more is kind of what Franklin experienced in that second floor. The second floor of that building was a solitary confinement cell. So William Franklin was by himself. In that space, he was not allowed human contact. He was not allowed pen or ink. Essentially, he was very much cut off from human activity. And in writing about it, Franklin described it as a dungeon. And he says that that's the only word he had for it, and that he was closely confined for about 8 months, overrun and molested with the many kinds of vermin. And he just goes into these descriptions about how this space is small, it's tight, he can barely stretch out. Things to know is that there is no bed in there, there is no chair in there, there is no toilet facility for him. There's essentially a straw mattress on the floor. So he describes the horrible smell because he is living in solitary confinement with himself, with his waste, that there are pests and vermin, and really that the only human contact he had was when his food would have been shoved through a tiny little window into him. And from reading the accounts, you know, it was not good quality food that he was being given. The other thing to know is this second story cell was up above the guards room of this jail, which also served as a tavern. So William Franklin, after the Revolution, speaks about how it was such this dichotomy of torture experience where he was living almost in this silence where he is cut off from fresh air, from human contact, and at the same time he is dealing with this ruckus of noise coming from this tavern space below him, and so he can barely even collect his own thoughts. I mean, thinking of the human experience, I cannot imagine what that would have been like in that space, in that situation.
I remember reading some time ago that he actually took on the, I guess you would say, the characteristics of a depressed human being.
Yes, absolutely. He, you know, got very despondent. He was very depressed. Physically, he was losing weight. And there were a lot of things playing into that. I mean, in that kind of isolation, it's absolutely expected and understood that, you know, that's going to happen. And then in these very brief glimpses where he was able to get outside information, he also found out that his wife had fallen ill. He was very concerned about what was going on with her, and he was unsuccessfully able to even really get the information he was probably just craving to understand what was going on with her at that time.
They find out, while he's still there, as I heard the story, that she actually ended up passing away. Is that correct?
Yes, and he had actually finally gotten permission from Sheriff Lord to be allowed access to pen, ink, and paper long enough that he did write a letter to General Washington requesting that he please be given a pass to leave the jail to go and visit his wife because he had heard that her health was so bad. And Washington had responded to him essentially saying, "It is not my place to grant that. I do not have that power. That is up to the Continental Congress." So Washington had passed that request on to the Continental Congress, who denied that request. And essentially, Franklin receives word that Congress said, "No, we're not granting you that. We think it's too big of a risk to give you access to the outside world." And the day before they made that decision, she had actually passed away already.
Wow, that's a chilling story. When he then gets released, what do you know of the decision-making process here? I mean, here's somebody that they're so concerned about having outside contact that they put him in isolation, and then suddenly there's going to be a prisoner exchange, and he's moved to East Windsor. How did all that come about? Do you know?
In September of 1777, he had again been given access to write a letter, and he had appealed to Governor Trumbull here in Connecticut, really requesting to be moved out of the Litchfield jail and to a private house. And there was precedent for that. There were other loyalists who were being imprisoned in private houses, and he was really just begging for that consideration because he was, you know, wasting away. He was in such horrid conditions. So how much of that plays into it, I'm not quite certain, but he definitely was making a campaign to be moved. And then nearer the end of the year, as you mentioned, he was moved out of the Litchfield jail. He was still a prisoner at this point, but he was moved to a private house as a prisoner in East Windsor, Connecticut. And from there, in December of that year, he was finally formally exchanged with the British. And at that point, he was released and sent back to New York City, where, I mean, I can't imagine this either. He continues to work for loyalists. He continues to be very committed to the crown and was doing what he could in support of the British cause while living in New York City, where we know a lot of action in the war is happening. And he remained there for a handful of years doing that work because he truly believed in it.
Yeah, it's almost as if he really believed the British were going to turn around sort of the course of the war and win. And it wasn't until Yorktown happened. Even after Yorktown, there's some indication that he was still active in 1782 in New York trying to pull off some miracles before he ends up going back to London for good, right?
Exactly. He's in New York City. He helped organize the Refugees Club, which was a group of loyalists. He helped form the Board of Associated Loyalists. And he really did hold on until the very end, I think holding on to hope that, you know, the king would prevail in the war. And as it turned out, as we all know, the king did not. And Franklin really at the end of that emerges as one of the most notorious loyalists, probably just after Benedict Arnold, that were here. And he left America in August of 1782 and moved to London and kind of, you know, lived out the rest of his life in exile in London, never to set foot back here in the United States.
Yeah, and at some point there, he tries to reconcile with his dad. He writes him a letter and his dad writes back and, you know, "No, I'm not gonna take the bait on this, huh?"
Yeah, I think both father and son were a bit tortured with their relationship that had really broken over the fact that William was remaining loyal to the crown and Benjamin was in support of the revolution. And there were a couple of attempts to reconcile. And in the end, it did not happen. Benjamin just could not forgive his son. He disinherited him. So there really was no relationship after that. There were attempts, and it just, between the two of them, they just could not ever get back on the same page.
So he, a couple of years after that failed attempt at reconciliation, he gets married again, then his wife will die. And finally, in, I guess it's 1813, William Franklin himself will pass away in London. And one of the most famous loyalists anywhere in the Revolutionary War story.
That's exactly how it ends. And, you know, he spent his time in London working for the Loyalist cause, actually, after the war, trying to support Loyalist claims. And, yeah, that's where his life ended. I suppose in some ways he ended up back in Britain, where he truly felt a loyalty. And it's hard to say what he felt in that situation nearing the end of his life.
Ben Franklin last visited his son on a swing through England on his way back from France. He'd been in France as a critically important diplomat with that country on behalf of the Patriot cause. Well, his visit was strictly to discuss remaining open financial matters, including the fact that he, Ben Franklin, was removing his son, William Franklin, from his last will and testaments. Up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. This story just goes to show you that you never know what another family, even one as prominent and seemingly successful as the Franklins, has to go through in life. Kind of reminds me of Thanksgiving dinners these days, with many families still torn apart over politics. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Jessica Jenkins. She's the executive director of the Litchfield Historical Society. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, the United Nations was not supposed to be in Manhattan. The original selection by the committee was for a town in Connecticut, and the question was, which town? Well, the answer is, it was supposed to go on a 41-square-mile parcel in Greenwich. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we'll look at how and why Greenwich was selected, as well as why the UN eventually ended up on the East River instead. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.